Church. Oh, it's good to be with y'all. Good to be together. I hope that you had a great Thanksgiving week. Got to spend some time, hopefully, with friends and with family and enjoy good food and a good celebration and a time of remembering all that you have to be thankful for. And we do indeed have so much to be thankful for, as we've talked about already today. And we'll probably be reminded of throughout this kind of coming holiday season. We've entered into one of what's become one of the busiest, most celebrated times of the year. We've got, you know, shopping and decorating and traveling and baking. I don't want to do any of those things, but some of y'all love doing that stuff. You're trying to get your friends and your families and your coworkers and your classmates together for celebrations, and you've got all of the food and the decorations that go with those, trying to get just the right things for your loved ones, trying to get just the right things for the people you don't even like that much. I mean, it is a lot of work this time of year, and it can feel, for some people, especially for some, not for everyone, but for some especially, it can start to feel a little overwhelming. It made me think about a particular video I saw a little while back. There was the catering cart at Chicago's O'Hare Airport. This was back on October the 1st. And the video of this incident went viral after this American Airlines unmanned vehicle began spinning out of control. And it's right next to a couple of airplanes, but that one in particular, right? Safe. Well, you saw the workers that were gathered there, and they were trying to figure out how to stop it, and they were like, hey, you can't jump in front of it, it'll kill you, you know? And that one quick-thinking worker thought to go and jump on a cart and just run it over. That seemed like the simplest solution. And as much damage as there was to his cart or to the catering cart, that was nothing compared to what would have happened if that thing had hit the airplane. I mean, that would have been catastrophic for that particular plane, at least. Have you ever been there? Or at least in a situation that feels like that, where things start spinning out of control in your life? I mean, it starts off with one simple thing. You know, somebody got off that cart while the accelerator was still depressed. They were trying to save a little bit of time, probably, And the next thing you know, it takes off and the wheel gets turned. I mean, it's just like one thing after another had to lead up to this literal spinning out of control. And that can happen in our lives really, really quickly when your relationship that started with one bad conversation or one little incident, and it's piled up on retaliation and then response and retaliation, and your relationship begins to spin out of control, or your job, you know, and things were going pretty well, and then there was one change in management, or one new coworker who started working on your shift, or one little incident that happened, and the next thing you know, your job is spinning out of control, or when your health is falling apart little bit by little bit, or when one little secret in your life gets out, and then it feels like everything's about to get out, stuff that you don't want everybody to know about, or when you're under that sort of pressure. How will you deal with it? I mean, everybody enters these tailspins of sorts. Everybody goes into the spin cycle at some point. The question is, how do we deal with that pressure? Well, in Mark's gospel, it appears from the outside that events are, when you're on the outside looking in at what's happening to Jesus, it looks like things are starting to spin out of control. I mean, Jesus is still speaking. Remember, he's in the Garden of Gethsemane, and he's just had his prayer, and he comes back to his disciples who have fallen asleep yet again, and he's talking to them, and he's telling them, you've got to get ready. Things are about to go down, and it's like almost mid-sentence, Jesus gets interrupted as he's warning Peter, James, and John. In comes Judas, leading this angry mob that's comprised of the chief priests and the scribes and the elders and their servants. And one moment, Jesus is seemingly in control of everything that's going on in his life. And then in the next moment, Judas is kissing him, and there's armed guards that sees Jesus. Someone draws a sword to protect Jesus. He cuts off the ear of one of the chief priest's servants. In the other gospel accounts, some of the other gospel accounts, we're told that the person who actually takes out a sword and cuts off a guy's ear, that was Peter. But in Mark's story, he didn't tell us who did that. Because Mark doesn't name names. Instead, what you get in Mark's account of this arrest of Jesus is more like a big picture. You get this mob, and you get Jesus, and you get Judas, and you get swords, and you get clubs, and these things are happening faster and faster, and then disciples are fleeing, or they're fighting, and then it ends, Jesus' arrest ends with one guy's trying to follow along, one young man, and they try to take him, and he runs off with his cloak behind. He just runs off naked into the night. And it sounds like a bizarre little detail to add into the rest of Jesus, but the idea is that things are just wild, right? Because up until now, it's been Jesus has been the actor. And I don't mean that in the fake sense, like he's pretending to do something, but he's been the one who acts. He's been the active one. He's been the one who does things toward other people. You know, Jesus heals someone. Jesus teaches. Jesus goes here. Jesus says this. Jesus is the actor. He's the one who does stuff. But things are different now. And from this point forward in Mark's gospel, Jesus is passive. He's the one who have things spoken to him, done to him. Jesus doesn't even speak unless he's spoken to, and only then with a few brief words. No more. We don't get any more speeches from Jesus. We don't get any more miracles from Jesus. We get nothing grand, nothing big. It's just like it's all happening to him. And in the meantime, we got all of Jesus' faithful followers. You know, Peter, Andrew, James, and John, and the whole other rest of the lot, and they just abandoned Jesus. They desert him. And Jesus is sort of left to face this monumental task all by himself. And that's a pretty bad feeling, isn't it? You had to go through something terrible, but you've also got to go through it by yourself. So now that's what Jesus is faced with. And this inevitable march towards the cross begins with two trials in the house of the high priest. Now, there are two informal trials, but there's actually two trials in Caiaphas' house. And it begins here in Mark chapter 14, beginning at verse 53. They took Jesus to the high priest, and all the chief priests and the elders and the teachers of the law came together. So here's Jesus for his trial. Peter followed him at a distance, right into the courtyard of the high priest. There he sat with the guards and warmed himself at the fire. Now, this is a strange place for a trial. In fact, there are three places inside of Jerusalem that Jesus' trial could be held. Three places that had legal precedent for holding a trial. Well, let me just spare you the details, but the house of the high priest was not one of those places. You don't hold court trials in people's living rooms, right? And yet that's where they carry Jesus. Because the high priest, Caiaphas, is not just a religious functionary. I mean, he's also the religious leader, but he's not just a religious leader. The high priest also served. He was like the go-between Israel and the Roman authorities. So he was really important figure because he had a religious purpose, and he also had a real distinct political purpose. And so they take him to this guy's house, to Caiaphas' house, and the job of these courts, that at least this what is supposed to be, was to enact justice so that you avoid a mob, right? Now imagine what it means. There's two things you got to avoid, by the way. We'll come back to the other one. If someone came to your home and killed one of your loved ones, and then they went back to their home, what would often happen was not just that you would go back out and find this person who'd committed murder or stolen or whatever they'd done and go and string him up, but you might say, and his whole family was protecting him too. So he killed one of ours, we're going to kill three of his. And they said, well, they killed three of ours, we only killed one of theirs, so we're going to go kill 10 of theirs. And it escalates, right? Because you can't ever get like the right amount of revenge. It just doesn't work that way. So the courts were there to keep that from happening. That's what lex talionis, eye for an eye and a tooth. That's right. That was not about like, yeah, you get them back just the way they got you. That was about, no, don't take two eyes. That's what lex talionis was about. He knocked out your tooth. That does not give you permission to put his face into a grinder, right? You get to take one of his teeth. That's what's fair. So the courts were supposed to enact that to keep everything fair and to avoid these angry mobs. And the second reason they were supposed to enact justice was so that God didn't come down and smite them. Right? Because if you don't enact justice towards the poor, towards the widows, towards the weak, towards those who are down and out and outcast, what happens is like Old Testament stuff. Biblical proportions, droughts and plagues and invaders. And I mean, you have got to enact justice or God will enact it for you. So that's what the courts were supposed to do. Enact justice to avoid a mob and to avoid divine retribution. That was their job. And what we have here is not that at all. This is neither one. What we have here are people who get together, and if you read through this Mark's account, and I'm not going to be able to read through it all because it's quite a lengthy passage, but you read through and you're like, okay, we want to put this guy to death. What should we charge him with? That is not the way court systems are supposed to work. Can you imagine if you get arrested and dragged by the officers and they all get together at the judge's house and they're like, listen, this guy needs to go away for at least 20 years. And we're like, oh man, what can we charge Bob with? Well, I don't know. And then they start scratching their heads and figuring out what to charge Bob with to put him away for 20 years. That's what happens with Jesus, except it's not 20 years, it's death. We want to kill him. What can we pin on him? What can we make stick on Jesus? And it's so funny, when they're trying to find this capital offense, they even in Mark's account, they're like, and so they brought forth witnesses, and one witness said, hey, he did some really bad stuff, but they could never get their stories to line up. And somebody else said, he said he was going to tear down the temple, which if you go back and read, Jesus never said he was going to tear down the temple. He said, the temple will be destroyed and I'll raise it up in 3 days. And people thought it was crazy for saying that, but he never said, I'm going to tear down the temple. And they're like, oh, we can't get him for, you know, Near Eastern terrorism, tearing temple down laws. And so they were like, what can we charge him with? And eventually the high priest just says, we can't even get our false witnesses straight. So he starts questioning Jesus. And Jesus has been watching this whole thing unfold mutely. I mean, he's standing to the side and people are coming forward saying terrible things about him, and Jesus says nothing. Nothing. I mean, his life is on the line and people are telling lies about him in front of his face and he says nothing. So finally, the chief priest the high priest turns to him and says, aren't you going to say anything about all this? Aren't you going to defend yourselves, answer these charges? Jesus says nothing. Doesn't even answer the high priest. And eventually, we get to this particular passage. Again, the high priest asked him, are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One? Maybe you've been here. I mean, the weight of the world is sort of pressing down, like your life is on the line, and all you have to do is tell one little lie or deny one single little charge or avoid one more little question. If you could just get out of the situation, and it is so tempting. I mean, who can blame Jesus here if with this angry mob surrounding him, people lying about him, intent on killing him? Who could blame Jesus if at this point Jesus had just said, I'm not answering that. I know what you want me to say and I'm not going to say it. I mean, would you blame Jesus for doing that? Here's Jesus in this situation and he's thinking, maybe he's thinking, you know, maybe they'll let me go. Maybe they'll release me. Maybe Jesus can go back to teaching his followers, back to healing the sick, back to raising the dead, back to spreading the good news of the kingdom of God. Maybe it'll all work out. There's a whole lot of reasons we can think here for Jesus to say nothing or even a little bit of a misleading statement. I'm not going to say Jesus would be okay to lie, but he can say something here that would misdirect them, right? Jesus was really good at that anyway. He would answer their questions and he would tell them something. And they thought he said one thing, but he really said something else. He could do that. Why doesn't Jesus do that here? But here's what really happens. I am, said Jesus. I mean, there's no hiding that. I am. And you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven. And just like that, Jesus' fate is sealed. He speaks up and he tells the truth, and that is all it takes. It is like a match to a powder keg. They'll accuse what's going to happen here is they're going to accuse Jesus of blasphemy. Now, that's not true at all. Jesus did not say something false about God. Neither did he take the name of God in vain. Like, he didn't even... In fact, he was very careful with his quotation. You see, Mighty One, he did not say the name Yahweh, which he was forbidden to say. That would be blasphemy if he had used the name Yahweh. But Jesus doesn't do that. He conflates two passages, one from Psalms and one from Daniel, and he mixes them in such a way that he doesn't have to say the name of Yahweh, and he puts those two together. But they're looking at this and they're like, aha, he has committed blasphemy. And that's certainly not true, but it's close enough for them. It is close enough for government work, we used to say. Right? So the high priest hears Jesus say that and he tears his clothes, which high priests are not supposed to do. He tears his clothes. The crowd begins to convulse. And the guards blindfold Jesus. And after they blindfold him, they begin striking them, begin hitting him, and they're just saying, prophesy. Now, in other gospel accounts we hear, what they're really saying is, prophesy, tell us who hit you. Right, to a blindfolded person trying to get him to say something wrong. Really just mocking him. It's like a grand celebration of anger and rage and vengeance. That's what we have going on here in the trial of Jesus. In the meantime, we still find Peter down below. He's still hanging out in the courtyard. And in some ways, Peter is facing a trial of his own. And this servant girl recognizes Peter. She says, hey, weren't you with Jesus the Nazarene? Weren't you with that guy? Maybe she was in the mob that came out, because we know servants of these priests and rulers were there. Maybe she was there and saw Peter. Who knows? But she recognizes Peter and says, weren't you with Jesus the Nazarene? And Peter says, I don't understand what you're talking about. Like, no habla inglés, sorry. And he puts a little more distance between himself and Jesus. He was in the courtyard, but he says, no, he backs out to the entryway. Like, you go through the entryway, into the courtyard, and then onto the house proper. Peter backs out of the courtyard all the way to the entryway, where he's just on the fringe now. And then another servant girl comes by, and she says, you're one of them, aren't you? And Peter's like, nope, not me. Denies again, right? And someone else nearby overhears this and says, surely you're one of Jesus' followers, one of them, one of Jesus' followers, because you're a Galilean, right? And Galileans are not normally hanging around Jerusalem. They're backwoods farmers. Surely you're one of them. You're a Galilean. And Peter just snaps. And he starts cussing and swearing and denying any knowledge of Jesus at all. I do not understand why you would accuse me of that. That is totally not true. I don't even know him, never heard of him. What is even going on here? So we get this picture of the difference between Jesus and Peter. And let's go back and review really quickly. Jesus is interrogated by Jerusalem's highest authorities, who have murderous intent. They want to kill him, right? Peter is confronted by a servant girl in the lobby who has no ability to harm him. The questions that are put to Jesus are all false. The statements that are made to Peter are 100% true and accurate. Jesus is falsely accused of cursing God. Peter curses and swears to avoid the questions. Jesus holds his ground faithfully and acknowledges his identity. Peter retreats, denies that he knows Jesus, denies his own identity. And so Jesus will go to his death, and Peter will go free. Jesus will go to his death, but his witness to his mission remains unsullied, unstained, shining bright, because Jesus has stood there and faced them and told the truth. And Peter will escape, but at the cost of his integrity as a disciple of Jesus. Yeah, he's going to get out of there alive, but he's always going to bear this shame of denying he belonged to Jesus. And maybe that's the crux of the matter, right? Because they each had different missions. Jesus' mission was to go to the cross, faithful and true. Peter's mission was to escape with his own skin. And so the question we have to ask ourselves this morning is what is your true mission? That is terrible. You can't see that. But that's what it says. What is your true mission? Is your true mission to escape consequences unscathed? Is your true mission to skate through life without controversy or opposition? Is your true mission to be financially or professionally successful, or to have people like you, or to avoid heavy obligations? Is that your true mission? Is your true mission to be comfortable? Is your true mission to be safe? Or is your true mission to embrace Jesus and your own identity regardless of the consequences? And even though you may not see it, there's a lot of irony in this story. Because in this story here, we have Jesus. Jesus has never sinned. We get that. But imagine this is in a relationship, right? Peter knows Jesus. He's walked with Jesus. He's lived with Jesus. He's eaten with him, slept in the same camp. And I mean, they know everything about Jesus you could know in 3 years, right? And in that time, Jesus has never done Peter wrong. He's never done anything wrong. Jesus has never failed. Jesus has never slipped up. He never backs down. And yet, Peter denies him. Peter, on the other hand, fails time and time again. He loses his temper, loses his faith. He forgets the mission altogether. Peter abandons Jesus. He denies Jesus. And yet Jesus, even though Peter does all that stuff, Jesus never denies Peter. Peter denies Jesus. Jesus never denies Peter. This morning, you have probably been through circumstances, though not as dramatic maybe as this, but you have been through, or you will be through, circumstances where it would be so much easier to just deny that one little part of yourself. That one part that says, I'm a faithful follower of Jesus. Because it would be more comfortable or easier for me, or more enjoyable for me, or less awkward for them. It's just going to make things easier if I just don't own this part of myself, and I can just deny this one little thing. Teenagers, you are like, you start off with very little, and then you get into the heat of it really quickly, and you think, like when you look at it, all these old people over there and over here, and you look and you think, oh, it's going to be easier when you get there. And in some ways, it will be easier. But it's only easier if you start making the right decisions now. Because if you start making the bad decisions now, it's just really easy to make bad decisions. Just look at some of these people. I mean, they've been doing it for years. And so you think, you think it's going to be easier, but the truth is we all have to make these decisions. Am I going to own my life in Christ, or is it my mission to be comfortable? This morning, I want to encourage you to step out of comfort and safety and step into your identity as a follower of Jesus. To own Jesus the way Jesus owns you. To accept Him as your Lord and Savior is one thing. To follow Him every day, that's the true challenge. And if we can help you with that, encourage you with that, if you need prayers of forgiveness or strength, or just want someone to walk with you, we want to do that. So if we can help you at all, won't you come now as we stand and as we sing?